This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. Before the show starts, I'd like to ask you to consider subscribing to News from Science. You've heard from some of our editors on here, David Grimm, Mike Price. They handle the latest scientific news with accuracy and good cheer, which is pretty amazing considering it can sometimes be over 20 articles a week. And you hear from our journalists. They're all over the world writing on every topic under the sun, and they come on here to share their stories. The money from subscriptions, which is about 50 cents a week, goes directly to supporting nonprofit science journalism, tracking science policy, our investigations, international news, and yes, when we find out new mummy secrets, we report on that too. Support nonprofit science journalism with your subscription at science.org/news. Scroll down and click subscribe on the right side. That's science.org/news. Click subscribe. This episode of the Science Podcast is supported by McDonald's. McDonald's new investment initiative is helping to add new renewable energy. They're investing in new wind and solar projects that will help create so much renewable energy, it'll be like taking more than 140,000 cars off the road for 1 year, or planting more than 11 million trees. It's just one more way McDonald's is using their scale for good. Welcome to the Science Podcast for November 29th, 2019. I'm Sarah Crespi. On this week's show, contributing investigative correspondent Charles Piller joins us to talk about delving into the confusing rules of the largest loan repayment program run by the National Institutes of Health. And I talk with Nate Lindsay about undersea communication cables that can be used as sensors for seismic activity on the ocean floor and also sensing waves. And for this month's book segment, Kiki Sanford talks with Dan Hooper about his book, At the Edge of Time, Exploring the Mysteries of Our Universe's First Seconds. Now we have Charles Piller, an investigative correspondent for Science. He's based in Oakland, California. Charles is here to talk about his latest story. This is on a very large loan repayment program run by the National Institutes of Health. Hi, Charles.
Hey.
Okay, so what is this program that we're going to be talking about?
This program is called the National Institutes of Health Loan Repayment Program, and it's designed to try to keep young investigators in academic science, even though they may owe in the hundreds of thousands on their school loans and might feel tempted to take a job with big pharma or perhaps in private practice, lucrative private practice, instead of staying in academic medicine, where sometimes the salaries can be lower.
I usually think tuition waivers, stipends, those kinds of things when I think of science graduate students. You know, usually some part of their education is paid for. Are these large loans that we're talking about, large debts?
Often it can be a massive amount of debt, and that's partly because many of these people in the program are scientific researchers who earn medical degrees.
Okay.
Consequently, they pay for medical school, which can be quite costly.
Mm-hmm. How much money are we talking about here?
Since 2004, about $1.1 billion has been spent on these loan repayments. In the last fiscal year, it was approximately $72 million. So this is a pretty large program, the largest of its kind, as I understand it, for academic science and clinical science.
This program is run by the NIH, by the National Institutes of Health, and it pays off scientists' loans. What do the scientists have to do to get these payments?
The way the process works is seemingly very straightforward. People apply to the program and they are selected based on the scientific merit of their proposal. Then the government pays off their loans if they qualify and continue to do research during the period their loans are being repaid by the government.
And it's need blind. So it's not, I have a lot of debt and a low salary. It's, I have some debt and some salary. Can you pay off my debt?
The financial need segment of the program, which is one very small element of it, only applies to less than 2% of applicants.
Oh, wow.
For most people, more than 98%, there is no means test. There is no financial need element to it. You're talking often about people who are earning $200,000, sometimes $300,000 a year, sometimes more, who are having all of their loans paid off and all the taxes on loans paid off. So look, I think it's terrific to have people supported by the government to stay in academic research.
Mm-hmm.
It's important and it's necessary. And I think very few people would disagree with that. I think the real issue is whether this program is being administered in a way that's fair-minded and makes sense within the context of what the need is.
How does it compare with smaller programs that do loan repayments? The ones that I've heard about before have been pretty strict about how long you have to spend in service or having a salary cap, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there are many government loan repayment programs with a wide range of different conditions. One of the things that I think is most remarkable about this is that many of the public service programs, like the NIH loan repayment program itself, have a service component. So for the NIH program, it's you have to continue to do research. It's not just free money. You have to do research. But of course, these are people who are doing research for their career. So it's not a hardship. It's what they want to do with their lives. For people in some of the other public service loan payment programs, you have to serve for 10 years in a public service job, paying off the loan as normal over 10 years. And then after 10 years, the rest of your loan can be repaid by the government. And even within these programs, the restrictions, the qualifications and requirements can sometimes be severe. Some might say draconian. There's one that's been in the news recently that has rejected 99% of applicants. These are for police officers, firefighters, teachers, other public service employees who have spent 10 years paying on their loans diligently and wanting to get the benefit of having the remainder of their loans repaid, but have fallen out of favor and have not been accepted to the program for kind of technical reasons.
What drew your attention to this program and what gave you the idea that it might need a close look?
It was brought to my attention by someone who had concerns that they had heard that the program might be paying off the loans of people who are also accepting large sums of money from pharmaceutical companies while they were getting their loans repaid.
Why might it be a problem for someone to take money from the government to repay their loans and then money from a nonprofit or the government to pay for their research and then also take money from a pharmaceutical company?
People who study the influence of drug companies on the drug regulation process and on research, medical research, have raised numerous concerns that the influence of pharmaceutical funding on young researchers or researchers of any kind can be profound. It's really been very well established that studies that are subject to industry funding can have much more favorable results towards positions that are beneficial to industry. So the concern is that if the government is paying off the loans of these young researchers to keep them in academic research, is it also appropriate for them to be establishing remunerative relationships with industry in a way that might influence the way in which they do their research?
Right. What did you do to kind of figure out whether or not these kinds of payments were happening and whether or not they were allowed?
This proved to be a very complicated and strange process. Initially, what I did is I called the program and had an interview with the person who heads it up. And she told me that the program had an absolute prohibition on people accepting either personal payments or research payments from pharmaceutical companies during the period they were accepting debt relief from the federal government. Not just now, but at any time in the history of the program, which goes back to 1988. After I had been told unequivocally about the way the rules work, I went back and I took a look at the representatives of the program called ambassadors. These are the people whose participation in the program is publicly known because they go up on a website and volunteer themselves as examples and resources for applicants to the program to contact and learn from. And so I thought, well, it would be interesting to know whether these folks, if they were following the rules properly. And what I found was that many of them were not. So I went back to the director of the program and I said, hey, I've found numerous cases of violations of the rules, or so it would appear from the data. And this is data that is publicly known data on the website operated by the federal government called Open Payments, where drug companies list the payments they make to doctors, either for research or for personal income. And what I found was that there were so many of these violations that I just felt I had to go back to the director and say, can I confirm with you that what you told me before about the rules, that I haven't gotten anything wrong or was mistaken in any way? And she unequivocally, again, confirmed to me that this was the case. So I felt that I was on pretty solid ground. But I also felt concerned that I needed to find all of the documentation associated with these rules and to very carefully examine it.
And they can change over time. Programs change with directors, with how they're funded and to comply with regulations. You know, since 1988, things have changed.
Indeed, they have. And what I found was that the rules had changed remarkably over the years. Mm-hmm. And the only way it was possible to learn what the rules were was to go back into the archival versions of the NIH website year by year, the most distant one being 2002, all the way up through today's set of rules. And what you can see is how the rules changed year by year by year. And I found, surprisingly, there were really dramatic changes over the years. For a while, anything was permitted, any kind of payment. Then it changed. And so people would normally imagine that you're responsible to abide by the rules that are publicly posted and established. And so that's what I relied on to map how the rules changed over time. And it was a complicated mapping process because there were so many rule changes.
Right.
And the language of the changes was at times complicated, ambiguous, difficult to understand.
You talked to some of these ambassadors. Was your sense that they understood what the rules were and that they were trying to follow them?
My sense is that the ambassadors were confused by the rules, that they didn't understand that they had violated rules, or they didn't, in many cases, even know that such rules existed.
And they turn in this information about their own compensation. So it's not that the loan repayment program was unaware that this was happening.
One would imagine. So according to these ambassadors, they disclose everything to the NIH, all of the payments that they received from drug companies and all of the conditions, and that no one at the NIH ever raised a concern about any of that. Now, the NIH refused to confirm with me that the specifics of any of these disclosures. They say they have a system in place to catch problems, to catch violations of the rules. But in my own review of the record, it seems that they rarely did catch these violations. After this process of learning more about the specific rules, I went back to the NIH and I laid it out to them. I said, here's how I see the rules based on your own published eligibility rules year by year. And what I don't understand is why you're saying there's no violations when it's pretty obvious that these rules were violated by many people and the documentation is clear that the violations took place.
Mm-hmm.
They pretty much responded to me saying that they disagreed, that they had their own view of the rules, which they had no documentation for, apparently, because they didn't supply it. It just led to a very perplexing situation where it appeared that the NIH was ignoring their own published rules and forgiving rule violations without any further action.
It sounds like there are multiple problems with this program. The rules are problematic. They're changeable and hard to follow. But also how the program itself is being administered, how it's being run.
Experts with whom I spoke, these are ethicists and experts in the influence of industry money, biomedical research, all were concerned about a couple of things. One is the sense of the program. At times, it allowed any amount of money for personal income or research from pharma. Then it prohibited those kinds of payments, either for personal income or research. It was in a process that was chaotic and seemingly without a clear sense of where the direction was of the program and why. The program manager says that industry money is not a consideration. It's not a factor in keeping people in academic research. And yet, right now, the program prohibits industry money for research, even though it allowed it before. So the question is, what is the sense of it? What's the purpose of the program? If it doesn't have anything to do with prohibiting industry influence on researchers early in their careers, why are there any prohibitions at all? And if it is concerned about those issues, why are the prohibitions so lax and so unenforced?
Thank you so much, Charles.
You're very welcome.
Charles Piller is an investigative correspondent for Science based in Oakland, California. You can find a link to his story at sciencemag.org/podcasts.
Stay tuned for an interview with Nate Lindsay about sensing seismic activity with undersea cables. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. Oceans are laced with giant cables, carrying information extremely long distances. In fact, all the continents have been connected by telecommunication cables since the late 1800s. It turns out that some of these cables, can do more than just pass information from one end to the other. They can also serve as sensors and tell us something about what's happening in the ocean and underneath the ocean floor. Nate Lindsay and colleagues test drove this concept in a paper this week in Science. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Sarah. How's it going?
Good. So telecommunication cables. How do these cables work and how can you adapt them to be sensors?
Underwater cables contain both power and the ability to pass light through the cable. That's what carries most of the internet.
Uh-huh.
And so that light that's passing is actually scattering along that entire piece of glass, that fiber optic cable. And we can probe those laser signals that are passing through that fiber optic cable to understand the environment of the cable itself.
Why don't we use satellites for moving this information around?
It really has to do with the bandwidth of the signal. I'm not a photonics expert, but the amount of information that you can carry on a fiber optic cable is just currently much more robust than satellite communication.
Let's talk about the cable that you used here. This was a special, I love that you call it a science cable in your paper.
The MARS cable, the Monterey Accelerated Research System cable, is located in Monterey Bay, California. And this was actually put out for science about 10 years ago by a group called the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. And it was put out to basically power and communicate with a science node, basically 50 kilometers into the Pacific.
Oh, wow.
It is an interesting location because it's both interesting for oceanography. Monterey Bay is one of the most curious spots. It has a giant canyon in the middle of it. There's a lot of faults between the San Andreas Fault and the San Gregorio Fault. And so there's a lot of interesting coastal oceanography you can study and also interesting geologic problems in kind of the seismic earthquake country of Northern California.
What did you do to turn it into a sensor along the length of the cable?
So there's a number of single mode fibers inside of this large cable. It's like different channels that are each going to a separate instrument. During a period of maintenance on the cable, we were able to occupy one of those single mode fibers from shore and send laser pulses down this otherwise unused dark fiber. And by analyzing how that laser light was scattering inside of the cable, we can measure the strain along the cable.
How long did you run these laser pulses for?
We had to operate inside of this maintenance period. That was about 4 days of recording. Then they needed to switch back on the instruments. It's kind of a facility operation. So we were able to kind of slide in a nice 4 day period.
During this time period, you could get readings from anywhere along the cable if something was happening.
By about 20 kilometers out into the fiber, we run out of photons.
They've scattered too much.
Yeah, so I mean, we're making measurements on the backscattering of the photons. So their travel path is basically out to 20 kilometers and back, and eventually we run out of photons. So that covers a large portion of the continental shelf underneath the ocean.
What kinds of things were you able to sense in this 20-kilometer span?
We were surprised by the amount of information we were able to obtain in 4 days. We saw earthquake signals, for example, which is something we've studied on shore with this fiber optic sensing technology. But we recorded a couple of earthquakes. Those kind of illuminate the entire run of the cable, and we're sensing that at a very dense spacing. So we can actually see, as a result of just passively recording an earthquake over 10,000 positions across the seafloor, you can see patterns of scattering, basically how that wave is arriving. It's being by the seafloor structures. And if you sample it dense enough, you can see those structures. Mm-hmm. We also saw oceanographic signals, like the surface ocean waves that you can see with your eyes and the kind of pressure field that's setting up on the seafloor. We resolved that again with just the cable sitting on the seafloor is basically being pushed by change in water level as a wave goes by.
That's very cool.
There's a number of other signals that are slower. So these are longer period signals, we say, whereas the earthquake energy is higher frequency, kind of above 1 hertz up to like 20 hertz. There's a number of oceanographic signals, such as infragravity waves, that are at longer periods of hundreds of seconds. The surprising piece of some of this work is this method is really sensitive to even longer period information, like 1,000 second, 18 minutes, kind of a signal going by.
What's cycling at that speed?
As a seismologist, I'm not really, I'm beginning to work in these kind of longer periods. It begins to be somewhat uncomfortable for a seismologist.
Like those waves are not my kind of waves.
Yeah, those are ocean waves, right, at that point. But actually, that's the interesting piece of this is it kind of bridges this ocean solid earth boundary. At 1,000 seconds, that period range, it could be one of two things. A seiche, which is like the sloshing of the water inside of Monterey Bay as it kind of propagates from one side to the other. Or it could be what are called internal waves. So there's like a density stratification in the oceans. Salty, cold water goes down to the bottom and warm, lighter water sits on top. And that stratification itself kind of moves towards the coast and breaks. It's a wave that's inside of the oceans that you can't see with your eyes. And so that internal wave, we think that that's actually the most likely hypothesis for what the signal is at 1,000 seconds. But it's very clear. It moves around with the tide, which suggests that it's not the seiche. Mm-hmm. It's also not the right period to be the seiche.
Has this kind of phenomenon been measured before, been observed before?
We actually benefit from being right in Monterey Bay, which is one of the best coastal regions in the world to be studying this kind of physics. And so, yeah, internal waves have been studied by Monterey Bay scientists and other scientific groups for decades.
And this is a new way of monitoring them.
Yeah, exactly. So there's been, single point. We go out and we put one pressure sensor and one temperature sensor at one location in the bay. But being able to record over 10,000 positions at the meter scale over 20 kilometers, that's the kind of advantage of this method.
What are some of the big questions that you could ask if you had longer runtimes and more cables?
One of the big challenges, I think, for seismic hazard in coastal areas, which are often located right next to urban centers, is the ability to sense those seafloor faults and the seismic hazard that is posed by those seafloor faults. It's a very expensive problem. It's a very logistically challenging problem to put instruments on the seafloor and keep them there for a long time.
Yeah.
Scientists have struggled with this for as long as we've been trying to make measurements of the Earth. I think that's really one of the biggest opportunities is to really, like the impact of this, I think, is to really be able to map seafloor fault properties mm-hmm. globally at an ability to basically do this wherever you can hook up to a single mode fiber
yeah.
from shore. That's one of the biggest opportunities that I see. But there's actually many others too, from an oceanographic standpoint.
We're all pretty greedy for communications bandwidth. Is it likely that some of these cables that already exist are going to be opened up for this kind of monitoring?
Sure. That's a good question.
Maybe we'll put down new cables and the old ones can be used for this.
So there's new fiber being put into the oceans all the time. And there's an opportunity to record on some of that existing fiber that isn't being used for telecommunications already. There's also a potential opportunity to record inside of a lit fiber. So inside of that piece of glass that's carrying the internet, there's a number of optical wavelengths. And just like radio spectrum, you can pack in many different signals. And so there's an opportunity to record this fiber optic sensing method inside of a fiber that's already carrying the internet.
Wow. All right. So you have one cable with 4 days of runtime. It's 20 kilometers of sensor. What if we did expand this to many, many transcontinental cables and we were running it all the time? Wouldn't we just drown in an ocean of data?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the question of data management for these fiber optic sensing experiments in the future is not quite worked out yet. Just like the amount of information that's coming back for astronomy these days, mm-hmm. there's terabytes of data. We recorded about 3.5 terabytes of information over just a 4-day period. We stored that on one external hard drive and then carried it back to our lab. But to basically constantly stream not just this one experiment, but many experiments, we actually need investment from a larger institution like NSF to actually allow us to build the types of facilities that we need to support this kind of data management issue.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much, Nate.
Thanks a lot, Sarah.
Nate Lindsay is the PhD candidate at UC Berkeley. You can find a link to his paper at sciencemag.org/podcast. Don't touch that dial. Kiki Sanford is up next, talking with Dan Hooper about his book, At the Edge of Time, Exploring the Mysteries of Our Universe's First Seconds.
Welcome to the book segment of the Science Podcast. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford. Dan Hooper, senior scientist at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, wants to understand the mysteries of the universe. And in his latest book, At the Edge of Time, Exploring the Mysteries of Our Universe's First Seconds, Dr. Hooper gives readers a sense of the many questions still yet to solve. Thank you for joining me today on the Science Podcast.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Why did you choose to focus this book on the first seconds of the universe?
I tried to focus on where the real mysteries lie, where the open questions lie. And that's in the first fraction or even, you know, millionth, trillionth of a second after the Big Bang.
What do you hope people get from this book?
I would like people to walk away going, wow, what the science of cosmology has done over the last 100 years is, you know, freaking amazing. Just the sense of awe and wonderment that I get when I think about this field of science. I'd like other people to have an opportunity to feel something similar. But also, I'd like to think that if you would like to understand what this whole field's about, you want to know, well, what does it mean when people say space is expanding? And what do people mean when they say the Big Bang? What's that all about? How do we know it happened? What are the open questions? If you read this book, you should be able to have a pretty good grasp of all of those sorts of questions. You know, if nothing else, it will make you more interesting at cocktail parties.
It's always a good goal. Can you give us a brief timeline? We've got the Big Bang, and then what happened?
So I find it easier to do this in reverse order. The universe today is expanding. That means that any two points in space, the distance between those points in space is growing as time advances. And that means in the past, any given volume of space was smaller, it had more stuff in it, therefore it was denser, and it was hotter. If you run these equations far back enough, you find a point where the universe was really hot and really dense, and we call that the Big Bang.
Right. And we can measure the expansion because of light in the universe. But what do the equations suggest about the stuff we can't see or can't detect?
In the first seconds or minutes after the Big Bang, the whole universe was 1 billion degrees at that point, or essentially the temperature of the core of a massive star. And under those conditions, the whole universe functioned as a giant nuclear fusion reactor, taking things like protons and neutrons and fusing them into things like deuterium and helium and other light elements. And then going back even further, we at least speculate that a number of other important transitions took place. We think that around 1/1,000,000 of a second after the Big Bang, the first protons and neutrons formed. We think that about 1 second after the Big Bang, many particles called neutrinos were released into space. And then we have speculation about things like how dark matter might have formed in those early times, speculations about how the universe came to be dominated by matter instead of antimatter. We still don't know how that happened, but it must have during that era.
And there's speculation about even further back?
we have pretty good reason to think that there was a moment shortly after the Big Bang where space expanded in kind of a burst. We call this cosmic inflation. We don't really know any of the details about it, but if we want to explain the universe that we see around us, we have to imagine that something like that took place. So that's kind of the timeline as we currently understand it.
In the first chapter, you make the statement that we can think of inflation as the true beginning of the universe we live in. Why is that?
We don't know much about the details of inflation, but roughly the picture is that in a time span of something like 10 to the minus 32 seconds, yes, that's 10 to the minus 32 seconds, if you can wrap your head around that, the volume of space grew by a factor of 10 to the 75, which is a mind-bogglingly huge number. So anything that existed in space before that expanded away from everything else at such an incredible speed that it essentially left the universe empty. And then the energy that was driving this incredibly rapid expansion suddenly got converted into particles and radiation. And it's that stuff that, you know, went on to drive the universe to grow and become the stuff we find in our universe today. So I don't know, maybe I'm taking some poetic license with the saying that you can think of the end of inflation as the beginning of the universe that we live in today. But in a real sense, everything that we have in our universe today is a product of the stuff that was produced or put into our universe, not before inflation, but only after as it was ending.
You also make the statement that if we're looking for a story with a nice ending, this book doesn't give it.
Yeah, sorry to disappoint.
What do you mean by that? Why is there no nice, easy story to wrap up here?
Well, over the last years and decades, cosmologists have tried to find resolutions to a number of problems. And we found those problems don't offer easy solutions. Our best guesses as to what those solutions might have been have turned out to not pan out when we did subsequent observations or experiments. So we're pretty confused about these things.
What are some of these problems?
The four puzzles I talk about. One is the puzzle of dark matter. We know that about 84% of the matter in our universe is not made of atoms, but of something else. This something else, whatever it is, does not appreciably radiate, reflect, or absorb light. That's why we call it dark. We call it dark matter, but we just give it a name. We don't know what it is. And we had ideas of what this might be, and we've done experiments that if we had been right about what we thought it might be, we should have found it already, but we haven't. So we're kind of going back to the chalkboards now and trying to come up with new ideas. Problem two is the problem of dark energy, not to be confused with dark matter. Dark energy is something that seems to dominate the energy density of our universe today, and it makes our universe grow faster at an accelerating rate. In other words, our universe is expanding even faster now than it was a billion years or 2 billion years in the past. We don't know what dark energy is. We don't know why it exists in the abundances that it exists in. I think it's fair to say all of our best attempts to understand dark energy have failed.
Okay, so far we are 0 for 2 as far as understanding anything. What's the third?
The third mystery is the mystery of inflation that I already mentioned. We have pretty good circumstantial evidence that something like that happened. We don't know what drove inflation to happen or, you know, the details of how it started or how it ended. And then the fourth and final question has to do with just the existence of matter in our universe. The laws of physics, as we understand them, say that anytime you create or destroy matter, you create or destroy an equal amount of antimatter at the same time. So if our universe started out full of equal amounts of matter and antimatter like we would have expected, then as our universe expanded and cooled, the matter and antimatter should have destroyed each other, leaving our universe essentially devoid of matter and therefore devoid of atoms. And yet, you know, you're made of atoms, I'm made of atoms, everything we know and experience is made of atoms. Something about that picture must be wrong. So something must have occurred in that first probably millionth of a second or so after the Big Bang. And during that time, matter somehow came to win over antimatter. And there's nothing we know about the laws of physics that help us to understand that. It is a big mystery to this day.
We still don't know where gravity comes from. People suggest there's a particle. There's been no particle found for gravity yet. And the Large Hadron Collider has not yet come up with any evidence against the standard model of physics.
No, not at all.
Everything seems all right, but we're still missing pieces.
We're clearly missing pieces. The standard model cannot be a complete theory. Nobody thinks it can be. The standard model suffers from a lot of problems that tell you that it's incomplete. You mentioned one, which is quantum field theory, including the standard model, doesn't play well with gravity as laid out by Einstein. So there has to be a quantum theory of gravity that supersedes either general relativity or quantum field theory or both, but we don't have any good evidence of what that might look like. It's fair to say we just really don't have a clue as to how gravity and things like standard model particles interact with each other at the highest energies or smallest timescales.
You bring up the grand unifying theory in the book, the idea that at some point we'll be able to take the quantum world and the world everybody lives in, reality, and put them together with some kind of mathematical ease. What are the hints there?
So people have been asking questions about how to build a grand unified theory or even something bigger, a theory of quantum gravity, for a long time. There have been a lot of moments where things look really promising. I'm not sure that we're going to have an answer to grand unification anytime real soon. That being said, many of the greatest developments in the history of science happened when no one was expecting them to.
One thing that was clear in the book covering the historical perspective, Einstein's theories kind of came out of nowhere, but they led to huge changes in physics and the way that we were able to conceive of the universe. It struck me that that is possible at any point in time. If somebody's somewhere thinking and comes up with a new way of looking at things that is unexpected, it could be a paradigm shift.
Absolutely. And it's really hard, if you look back in the history of science, it's really hard to tell when that's about to happen. You can't see a scientific revolution coming. I like to ask colleagues of mine, you know, when we're just having a conversation over a beer or something, what they think it would have felt like to have been a physicist in 1904. 1904 is special because it's the year before Einstein started the series of breakthroughs. And if you went and asked physicists in 1904 what they thought about the state of their field, they would tell you about how amazingly successful it had been and how they basically have problems at hand wrapped up. Newtonian physics had been successful for centuries. They keep encountering new problems, which they managed to address within the Newtonian framework. There just didn't seem to be any reason to think a revolution was about to break out. Now, in hindsight, you can look back at that time and say, well, there were some signs that you needed a revolution, but in hindsight, it's easy to say that. So looking back on it, we can say we needed Einstein or someone like Einstein to come along to solve these problems, and he did with a combination of the theory of relativity and the theory of quantum mechanics. But at the time, I think people just said, well, these are going to be things that as we study Newtonian physics more, we'll be able to break and understand. And that turned out not to be true. You needed a real paradigm shift. So I sometimes wonder, like, is it possible we're in a 1904 situation now where we look at problems like dark matter and dark energy, matter and antimatter and inflation, and we're trying to apply the sort of tools we know about and have long applied to these problems. But in fact, maybe we need something totally different that we're not thinking of yet. And I don't know what that something else might look like, but I'm hopeful that there'll be a big paradigm shifting revolution at some point, maybe soon, maybe later. But I hope I'm around to see it. It sounds exciting.
I hope you are too. I hope many of us are around to see it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining me for this interview with Dan Hooper about his book, At the Edge of Time, Exploring the Mysteries of Our Universe's First Seconds. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford, and I hope that you'll join us again next month for a peek between the pages of another science book.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Salk Institute. The Salk Institute has a new podcast called Where Cures Begin, which shares scientists' stories about their cutting-edge discoveries. Hear from scientists whose breakthroughs aim to change the world. These scientists are exploring the mysteries of the brain and sleep. They're coming up with new approaches to tackle climate change and cancer. Subscribe to Where Cures Begin at salk.edu/wherecuresbegin. That's salk, salk.edu/wherecuresbegin. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can listen to the podcast on the Science website. That's sciencemag.org/podcast. There you'll find links to the research and news discussed in the episode. Or you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Pandora, and so many other places. The show is produced by Sarah Crespi and edited by Podigy. Special thanks to Megan Cantwell and Joel Goldberg. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, Triple S, thanks for joining us.